Moncrief on News Talk. From the heinous to the ridiculous. This is Moncrief's Murder Club.
It is Wednesday, which means it's time for the Moncrief Murder Club with Cassie Delaney, and she joins me in studio. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. We're looking at twists at trial this week. So cases that got to trial and things got a bit twisty-turny.
Wanted that kind of like aha moment, the gasp from the courtroom kind of reaction. So I've got three stories where that happens. Sometimes in these stories, there's multiple twists and turns across the investigations and into the trial. These are one that's probably quite well known and two that I don't think anybody will have heard of before.
Yeah, because this first one, when I started reading, I was like, okay. And then when the details come out, you go, oh, yes. Unfortunately, yeah. I do know this and I've watched the Netflix adaptation of it. This is Michael Peterson and the Staircase.
Yes. So this is back in 2001. At around 2:23 in the morning, a 911 operator in North Carolina takes a call from a man in absolute hysterics, saying that his wife had fallen down the stairs. She was still breathing. Then he hangs up and calls back a few minutes later to say that she's not breathing anymore. That, we know, is Michael Peterson. This was an incredibly successful series on Netflix a couple of years ago because it is so bizarre. So Michael Peterson was a novelist and a columnist, a former Marine and a man who had run for public office twice. His wife was Kathleen Peterson, a senior executive at Nortel, and they were, you know, by all intents and purposes, a really gorgeous family. They were, to the outside world, this golden couple. They had the big house, dinner parties, five children between them from various marriages. And they had been just like having a couple of drinks in the house, watching a film, as you would do if you lived in a mansion with a pool.
Yeah.
Just sitting out there enjoying their lives. So when paramedics arrived, they found Kathleen at the bottom of a narrow back staircase and they found blood everywhere. So an enormous amount of blood up the walls, across the steps, soaked through her hair. And anyone who's seen the photographs quickly was like, that seems like more than just a fall down the stairs. Kathleen had severe deep lacerations about the back of her scalp. So Michael Peterson, very quickly, fingers pointed at him and he is charged with her murder. Then when we get the trial in 2003, it becomes one of the most scrutinized trials in American legal history, partly because the documentary crew were in there filming for what would become The Staircase. And just because of this sort of the fanfare around the whole thing.
Yeah.
So prosecution had a really big problem with the trial in that there was no weapon. And Kathleen's skull, despite these lacerations, wasn't fractured at all, which is really unusual for a case where you would assume that someone had undergone a beating. So the case came down to blood, and the state's analyst, a man named Dwayne Deaver, hard name to pull off, testified that the spatter patterns on the walls could have only come from repeated blows. So his testimony in the trial was really significant.
Yeah.
Remember that name. So the defense, led by David Rudolph, argued that she had fallen, hit her head and tried to get back up and slipped and fallen again. But the prosecution then whips out this motive. And that is a little bit of a bombshell. So investigators had found emails showing that Michael Peterson had been arranging to meet a male escort. And the state argued then that Kathleen had discovered his secret life and it had turned into a row, had turned lethal.
Yeah.
Now, the defense argued that Kathleen kind of knew who he was and accepted him, and that this was a move to kind of undermine him at trial.
Yeah.
But here's the big twist in this case during this trial. Mid-trial, prosecutors really revealed that 17 years earlier in Germany, a close friend of Michael Peterson's named Elizabeth Ratliff had also died suddenly. She was found by her nanny at the bottom of her staircase in a pool of blood, and the last person to see her alive the night before was Michael. So that doesn't look great.
No, it really doesn't.
Really,
certainly not.
Really hard one to come away from. He had also then become the legal guardians of her two girls, Margaret and Martha, and raised them as his own. And during this trial, Margaret and Martha are sitting behind him thinking he's innocent. So what an absolute blow to them. Elizabeth's body was exhumed from a cemetery, and her death, though it had been originally recorded as a stroke, the new autopsy concluded that she had died of homicidal assault with injuries very, very, very similar to Kathleen's. So the judge let the jury hear all of this. Two women 17 years apart on two different continents, dead at the bottom of a staircase, and one man who was present at both.
Mm.
So in 2003, he was convicted of murder and sentenced to life without parole. But then we get another twist. In a few years into the sentence, a neighbour of the Petersons, a lawyer named Larry Pollard, proposed what has become known as the owl theory. And this is the real kind of big thing in the Netflix series.
Mm.
Kathleen's scalp wounds were not blunt force injuries, he argued, but talon marks. And a barred owl, which oddly was a species known to attack people in that very neighbourhood, had struck her outside. He says she stumbled inside bleeding and had fallen on the stairs. It was kind of ridiculed. I mean, it was made fun of everywhere. It's in pop culture that we know this owl theory. But there were microscopic feather fragments reportedly found clutched in her hand along with her own hair, as if she had put her hand to her head.
Like, what?
What do you believe? Like, I mean, it's one of these cases that I think of all the time that I'm like, okay, that is plausible. But then the fact that the friend was found before as well dead, I'm like, if he didn't do it, this is the most unfortunate coincidence ever.
Yeah.
Absolutely crazy. And then another final twist. Dwayne Deaver, our blood splatter expert, whose testimony was so central to the first trial, he was investigated and found to have misrepresented evidence in dozens of cases across his career. So he was fired in disgrace. And in 2011, a judge threw out Peterson's conviction, ruling that Deaver had misled the jury. So he was able to walk out on bail after 8 years in prison. And then rather than gamble on a real retrial, he entered a plea to manslaughter, which is kind of just a strange sort of loophole in American law, where if you formally plead guilty while maintaining your innocence, you can be released with time served. So he was out and about.
They did such a good, well, I suppose this could be argued, but I just found it so interesting in the Netflix series. It's Colin Firth and Toni Collette are playing the couple. They do such a good job in the first three episodes of outlining or kind of putting forward each possibility as to what happened. Mm. And again, you kind of hear the owl thing and you're like, that's ridiculous. And it's not that they play it for laughs in the show either, because they don't. But like, you see it and you're like, this is nuts. Like, how could this possibly happen? But then also when you look at all those things like the skull injuries and stuff.
The fact that the skull wasn't fractured.
It's just
so strange. And then I'm like, if a big owl got into your gaff, you probably would fall over and die.
And especially if it's an owl that attacks people for some reason.
New fear unlocked. I didn't know that was something to be concerned about.
What is going on with those owls, guys? Okay, that's the staircase. This is another one, as well. I actually wasn't super familiar with this second case, Colin Pitchfork.
This is really interesting because it's one of the first times DNA evidence is used in a criminal trial. So we begin in Leicester countryside, like really quiet villages out here. You've got three villages at the centre of this story, and it's the kind of place where everybody knows everybody, connected by like those little dark footpaths. So we've got two places called the Black Pad and 10 Pound Lane. And we're in November 1983. Unfortunately, there's a 15-year-old woman called Linda Mann who's taking a shortcut along Black Pad on her way to a friend's house, but she never arrives. Her body was found the next morning and she had been assaulted and strangled. Police did manage to recover a semen sample and could determine the killer's blood type, which narrowed things down to about 10% of the men in the country.
Mm.
But that's where the science stopped in 1983. That's about as far as they could go. So the investigation ground on for months and then goes cold. 3 years later, in 1986, it happened again, an almost identical crime. A 15-year-old girl called Dawn Ashworth taking a shortcut home through 10 Pound Lane. And you can imagine that 3 years on, you're sort of easing out of the fear, I guess, that it would have caused previously and maybe letting up a little bit more, taking the paths that you probably wouldn't have taken directly after this crime. But she was found 2 days later. She was hidden in a field. Same method, same signature. It must have been the same man. These are two schoolgirls just 3 years apart, less than a mile between them. So the police moved in fast and they landed on a local teenager called Richard Buckland. He was only 17 years old at the time. He was a kitchen porter. He'd been seen near the scene. He was known to the police and he seemed to know details about Dawn's body. So under questioning, he actually confessed to killing Dawn Ashworth, but maintained his innocence around the Linda case. So he denied it. But the police kind of thought it was only a matter of time before he cracked. Now, simultaneously, elsewhere in the country, something remarkable is happening. And that is a geneticist named Alec Jeffries had this kind of eureka moment where he was looking at X-ray film of a DNA experiment and realized that DNA had certain patterns that he could identify. And they were all individual to that DNA. You know, DNA fingerprinting kind of thing.
Mm.
So it had been used in an immigration case, but never in criminal justice anywhere in the world. So the police asked Jeffries to do something, to basically use his new technique to prove that Richard Buckland had murdered both girls, because they had him in custody. And when Jeffrey ran the samples, the results were super clear. The same man had absolutely killed both Linda and Dawn. The profiles matched each other perfectly, but that man was not Richard Buckland. It was not the 17-year-old who had confessed to Dawn's murder. So the boy in custody who had confessed was not present at either scene. And if this technology had existed kind of a year or two before, he never would have ended up in prison for it.
It's nuts.
So they were armed with this knowledge that it had to be the same man, and they did have the man's DNA. So what they did was this absolutely incredible hunt to try and find the real killer. So they asked every man between 17 and 34 who lived or worked in those three villages to come and voluntarily give blood. Over 5,000 men came in. Now, it was legal to refuse, but if you refuse, you were talk of the town. It's very suspicious to do it. And naturally, the screening failed. So every sample came back negative, even after the 5,000 samples. The killer seemed to have beaten the most ambitious forensic operation ever recorded, except it had been beaten by cheating. And people who cheat tend to get a little bit chatty when they're in the pub having a pint. So in August 1987, in a pub, a bakery worker named Ian Kelly was having a pint with his colleagues when he mentioned that a workmate of theirs, a man named Colin Pitchfork, had persuaded Ian Kelly to take the blood test for him. So Pitchfork had essentially put his own photograph onto a doctored passport, had coached Kelly on his details, had driven him to the testing centre, had waited outside while Kelly gave the sample under the false name. So Pitchfork's excuse was that he had already given his blood sample to a friend of his because his friend had been done for flashing and he didn't want to get him in more trouble.
Right.
So a woman in the pub overhears this story, sits on it for kind of like 6 weeks and is like, I don't really know what to do with this information, before taking it to the police. And eventually they brought Colin Pitchfork in for mandatory testing. He was a man who, he was a local baker. He had two kids. He had a history of exposing himself to women, and he was arrested and formally charged in 1987. So he pleaded guilty in January 1988, and he is the first murderer in history convicted using DNA evidence to save his life. But interestingly, the young fella is the first guy in history who's been found innocent and exonerated because of DNA evidence.
I mean, it just prompts so many questions and like thoughts. It's crazy how new that technology is when you consider it? Like this is such recent history. What would have prompted him, Richard Buckland, to admit to this crime when he didn't do it? Again, I can imagine the pressure and the coercion under police questioning, I would imagine.
I think he must have had some relationship with Dawn.
Yeah.
He must have known about her anyway and some way felt guilty. Like I wouldn't be surprised if he had been with her prior to it and something had happened.
Yeah.
Or he felt in some way connected to the case, or maybe he was just put under pressure to confess. We see that often.
Thank God for women in pubs. That's what I say. Case three then, this is another one that I had not heard of.
This is another kind of big twist as well. So this is a twist for a different kind of way. And it's a point in time where you see how information presented at trial can really undermine someone's character. This is a very sad story. And I will warn you up top, this has no real ending or resolve to it. This is the case of Sean Jenkins, and we're in 1997 on the south coast of England in Hastings. The Jenkins household is a lovely, busy one. Sean Jenkins is the deputy head teacher at a local school. He's about to be promoted to head teacher. His wife Lois is there. They have four daughters and a foster daughter called Billy Jo Jenkins, who by coincidence just shares their last name. She had come from a family in London. And by 1997, she was living with them for so many years. She was just ingrained in the family. She was just one of them. On the afternoon of the 15th of February, Lois was out and they were doing kind of your little pottering weekend jobs, you know, tidying up the garden. And Billy Joe was on the patio painting the doors in the sunshine. At some point that afternoon, Sean Jenkins drove to a DIY shop with his other two daughters to buy white spirits, a trip that probably took about 15 or 20 minutes. Mm. But when he returned, he says he found Billy Joe lying on the patio in a pool of blood and she had been beaten with savage force. But the weapon was an 18-inch metal tent peg that had come from the garden. So definitely a crime of opportunity. Someone had picked up a tent peg.
Someone in the vicinity, very close vicinity.
Yeah, had been there and picked up. Definite kind of not a premeditated attack, I would imagine. But within days, the investigation had narrowed it down to the man who'd found her. And they were saying that Sean Jenkins was responsible. He was charged with murder. And the case against him was so minuscule. So on his fleece jacket and his trousers, forensic scientists found 158 droplets, but I mean sprinkles of blood. Each one was microscopic, smaller than a millimetre, a fine mist rather than a kind of blood spatter or smears. And the prosecution's experts said the only way that you would have had a mist like this is kind of repeated regular impact. It's like a splatter pattern that comes from impact. But he said he had simply crouched over her and touched her and tried to help. But the jury did not believe him, and he was convicted of murder, sentenced to life in prison. His marriage falls apart and his wife goes off to Tasmania with the rest of the family. But his legal team kept pulling at the science, and they produced an explanation that turned its entire case on its head. Billie Jo's head injuries had caused bleeding into her airway, and pathologists found evidence of trapped air and blockages in her upper airway. And the defense experts argued that as Jenkins leant over her and moved her, the pressure on her chest would have forced out like a kind of breath, an exhalation, and that that's where the mist would have come from. So very sad that it's likely that the evidence that had this man convicted is actually just evidence of a very bereft man bending over his daughter in her final moments. Very, very sad. But the kind of big twist in the trial had come when they were going through Jenkins' background, and it was revealed that everything in his history had been based on a lie. Everything in his career had been a total fiction. So you remember I said he was being promoted as the head teacher.
Yeah.
He had lied about his education. He had no degree. He had no qualifications. And so the tide just really turned on this man. And even though he seemed like a very grieving father and was a grieving father, the fact that he'd been proven a liar in trial because of his work history, just he never recovered reputationally from that.
Yeah. Like, what else are you capable of lying of?
That's it.
My God, fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Cassie Delaney for the Moncrief Murder Club. Thank you so much for that.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.